Everybody. This is Elizabeth Thompson, the Executive Director of the Buckminster Fuller Institute, and welcome to the Dymaxian Reading Group. We have, on the occasion of the 120th anniversary of Buckminster Fuller's birth, we have launched this distributed reading group, and the response has been fantastic. We're so glad that you've joined us. This is a first for us. We're experimenting with the form, and we want to be as responsive as we can to your feedback about your experience. At the end of the session, you will be receiving from us a very quick survey. We hope you will take the time to answer our questions so we can iterate the format each week. Tonight we will be discussing for the second session Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth. This is one of the best entry points into Fuller's key ideas and an absolute must read for anyone interested in Bucky's ideas.
Wow.
That must be a start bell. We are right next to a church, so I think I'll pause. We can all gather our thoughts here while we allow the bells to play out. Okay. All right. So we are, for those of you who are joining us for the first time tonight, welcome. We have structured the discussion on each of the three sessions to really cover some key themes found in this particular book, but on a broader level found in Bucky's ideas in general. So you haven't missed anything. We know from the feedback that we had from our participants last week that some of you have read the book and many of you have not and are here to engage in a discussion about these key themes. So there was no homework assigned before joining us. We hope that the discussion will inspire you to check the book out. And if you don't know about it already, the Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth is now available for the first time ever in an e-reader format on Apple iBooks and now on Kindle. This is the first publication of Fuller's that is available in this format. We're delighted by this development and encourage you to go and get a copy and download it. As I mentioned, this is our second of three sessions that we're spending on Operating Manual. We'll move to a new text in the fall, which we will announce in a couple of weeks. I want to thank all of you who have joined us who are members of BFI. If you are not already a member, I'd like to invite you to join us. Your support really helps us offer these kinds of programs and a lot of other educational programming to as many people as possible. All of our work can be viewed on our website at bfi.org. We invite you to join us and are delighted you're here tonight. Let's see. This week we are going to be experimenting, evolving our format and opening up the discussion for more of you who have joined us to make your comments, share your insights verbally during the session. I'm going to just go through how we're going to facilitate that. You'll see in your control panel a hand. What we will ask you to do is to raise your hand by clicking that button if you have something that you would like to share in the discussion. Then use your chat window to just give us a quick overview of the topic that you want to weigh in on or what it is generally that you want to share. We will then find a good moment in the discussion to invite you to share your comments, and we will do that by unmuting you. Bear with us as we are. This is a fluid process for us, but we look forward to having you to evolving this sort of interactive capacity and experience of these reading groups. So without further ado, I would like to now introduce you to our session moderator and our respondents. Pablo Freund was the former managing director of BFI. He recently left the Institute to run his own social venture called B-Girl, which he co-founded. It's a fantastic enterprise. I encourage you all to check it out at bgirl.com. We also have three Fuller scholars who have joined us as respondents. They are Greg Watson, who is a former board member of the Buckminster Fuller Institute. He is now director of policy and systems design at Schumacher Center for New Economics. Kurt Prisbilla, who is an inventor, educator, and a longtime associate of BFI, offering workshops in synergetic geometry. And Linda Booth Sweeney, who is a systems educator and award-winning author. Welcome to you all. Thank you so much for joining us. And on that note, I'm going to hand this over to Pablo, who can get us going with our discussion.
Thank you, Elizabeth, and welcome, everyone. Welcome back for those who are joining back, and welcome back to our panelists. I wanted to thank everybody for giving us feedback the last time and helping us shape a better discussion. So today we are starting in a more structured way, but we're going to then open it up. And so I'm just going to jump right in and start with our first discussion question. On this vision of a world in which the question, where do you live, what are you, what religion, what race, or what nationality, are thought of today as logical questions, but Bucky says that the 21st century, they'll either become evident to humanity that these questions are absurd or anti-evolutionary, or man will no longer be living on Earth. So really the question is, now some time has passed from then, and we know that prediction didn't come, but the warning is very relevant. And it makes us think about what's going on Earth right now and how we are divided. It really talks about, I think Buckminster Fuller all around in his work, starting with the Dymaxion map, wanted to and talking about spaceship Earth, wanted to talk about it's everybody or nobody, he would say, right? So I think it's very also really interesting how this week's Scientific American, on the cover it says, how we conquered the planet, our species wielded the ultimate weapon, cooperation. So what is separating us right now? And I wanted to share with you what I thought about the notion that these questions about what separates one human from another are constructs that we can't run away from. They're implicit bias. An implicit bias is it's a habit of thought that leads to an error in perception, and that's how people make decisions. Why have we not superseded this limitation of implicit bias when we are in this interconnected world? So with those thoughts, I wanted to open up the discussion to our panelists. And is there any takers to respond?
Sure. This is Kurt, for those that don't remember or know. I think that the thing that really attracted me to Bucky when I was first exposed to his writing was how broadly he would address that question, and the history that he lays out in this book of the history of specialization with the great pirates really attracted me, because it may seem a little bit outlandish, but at the same time, if you're trying to imagine how we got to where we are with all of these different political boundaries that are, I think, the thing that separates us and still exist. And he points out that, you know, even though we had developed the ability to annihilate the whole planet in 1946, when we founded the United Nations, all of those boundaries still existed, and actually a bunch of new ones were drawn. And I think that underlies the foundation of which we need to change things, and that's why I like the beginning line, the quote at the beginning of Synergetics, where dare to be naive, and we talked about, and he often talked about children, so that comprehensive nature of humanity from childhood on is, I think, frustrated by this long history on the planet of sovereign nations, and he used to call them the having 180 different captains on the same ship.
Right. Very interesting.
Yeah, this is Greg, and I think that, you know, one of the things I think that Bucky points out, though, is that the separation is a necessary part of our sort of collective learning process. Because, you know, he said we were clearly all born at a single origin, single mother, and then over a period of time, we migrated away from our point of origin. You know, sea levels went down. Some people took off and explored. Some people stayed in the original motherland. But that sense of sort of spreading out and migrating out was part of the process whereby humanity sort of started to accumulate the total inventory of those principles, those eternal principles, those that we talked about last week, out of necessity, because we migrated to different environments that required us to call upon the different set of skills as we migrated out. And I think what he then said was that we would slowly reconnect. And as we the idea of reconnecting and us bringing together our collected set of tools would allow us to transcend, allow us to participate in this consciously in this process of planetary evolution. So it's sort of like, but that's the most difficult part. The most difficult part is we've forgotten that we had the common origin, or at least it's probably there in our unconscious memory. But, and we have developed because of physical differences that were a part of us settling in different environments, right? You know, skin color, our eyes, you know, everything, because we were in different environments, and that superficial sort of difference overcame what was obviously a common ancestry and a common origin. So now the challenge is to, we just said, we've got to break those down and then bring back to the fold that collective wisdom, that set of principles that of nature's coordinates that will give us the, I think, sort of the ability. Now, it's not a guarantee. And that's why I think what Bucky was saying, and this is sort of he used the terminology pass-fail. And either we will pass that test, and he called it, I think his concept I love is the womb of permitted ignorance, where we don't realize what the sort of our purpose in this whole scheme of things is. And so we make mistakes, we separate from one each other, we fight one another, but eventually we're going to have to reconnect. And I think that, you know, you can clearly see that a lot of the isms have broken. I mean, communism, people are questioning capitalism, socialism in Cuba, broken down. And so and now we have the tools, for better or for worse, and right now maybe a little bit for worse, but social media does provide some tools for us accelerating that process of reconnecting globally and understanding what we have now in common as opposed to what separates us.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, Greg, that we're going back to origins, in a sense, as cooperating beings.
This is Elizabeth. I just would love to have you all sort of respond to, you know, your perspective on how the role of design in getting us to this place where we're going to be living more sustainably. You know, it's a big question, but, you know, Bucky called for a design science revolution. How does that design science revolution address the urgent crises today and more deeply integrate us into the felt experience that we are all one human family all in need of the resources of Spaceship Earth.
Well, and I think that the whole Malthusian aspect to it, the Darwinian Malthusian aspect of the competition that is set up that Bucky goes through at the beginning of this book, and that's the result that we're dealing with. The thing that, again, Bucky always appealed to so many people, I think, is because he always transcended those boundaries that we've set up that are actually the idea that there's not enough for everybody is what has caused all of this warring. And it's basically obsolete because now we have the ability to provide a higher standard of living for everybody on the planet. And that was what he stressed. And there's a great quote from Utopia or Oblivion, The Prospects for Humanity, that speaks to it directly. It's, "Revolution by design and invention is the only revolution tolerable to all men, all societies, and all political systems anywhere. Every nation welcomed the invention of the airplane and refrigeration." So I think that that's how design transcends it. Twitter is spread all over the world, as has Google, and many different versions that are replicating it in their own languages. But those design inventions are transcending those political boundaries. And I love to point out that the Dymaxion map never has the boundaries drawn in them on it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things that Bucky often stated, and people sometimes misinterpreted, but he said that nature is ultimate technology. Principle, they call it technology, in his view, is metaphysical. It's the principles. It's not the backhoe. It's the principle of leverage. And over and over again, you see, for example, he says the most incredible examples of technology, for instance, you know, the hydraulics, which he was really very big on. He says you take a look at a huge tree in a storm, and if that tree is healthy, and you've got these limbs that weigh hundreds of pounds being blown about and back and forth and swing, and they give, they don't break because of the hydraulic system in there. And he also sort of observed that, again, that over the 4 billion years of, you know, again, really Earth, Spaceship Earth, being sort of the ultimate example of what we now sort of understand is possible, that is sustainable development, not sustainable growth. The Earth over 4 billion years has sustained the conditions necessary for life, and it's done so, as Bucky often pointed out, with only one incoming source of energy, that being sunlight. And the Earth has not grown in 4 billion years, well, at least maybe a little bit, but not, you know, again, with incoming solar dust, cosmic dust, and all, but for the most part, it stayed the same size, but it has rearranged the parts. It's, you know, and it's done so in a way, it's, you know, it's the evolution, right? Some niches open up and some close, some species, some come and go. The lesson there is that 99% of the species that have lived on the planet have become extinct, but the conditions necessary for life have prevailed. What humanity has the option to do in terms of taking those principles, those design principles that are operative in nature for all of us to see, understanding how we can eventually do more with less, and therefore support even, you know, again, I know there, at least a population that is expanding, but do it with less resources and higher standard of living. Those are not pipe dreams. Those are realities if we were to understand, when we understand and apply those principles that have been, what can I say, tested, you know, field tested for 4 billion years. So the design challenge is, how do we learn from nature? How do we take and understand that there's a reason why nature, that tension and compression, as he often says, are part and parcel of the same system. You can't have one without the other. You take a rope and you pull it and tense it. It stretches in one direction, but its girth, you know, shrinks. There's tension and compression. You can't separate out the two. But what he pointed out is that nature always emphasizes tension and de-emphasizes compression, because most materials are stronger in tension than they are in compression. Now, those have all sorts of implications for design, for architecture, and as he's pointed out, and how we do things so that we can build shelters, we can produce life support for growing numbers of people, but by using less and less resources. It seems counterintuitive, but it's the way that nature works. And so that's and it's an option that's very subtle, and it certainly is not the thing that is promoted by most governments who are in a command and control, because this type of technology, this type of design approach is very democratic and can be made available to everyone as opposed to being controlled by powers.
Thanks, Chris. I think that's a really great segue, actually, to the second question on our discussion topics today, because it talks about the applied principles, right, and how that benefits humanity. So I'll start just reading off this excerpt, and we'll jump right into the question. So Bucky says, "The adequately macro-comprehensive and micro-incisive solutions to any and all vital problems never cost too much. The production of heretofore non-existing production tools and industrial networks of harnessed energy to do more work does not cost anything but human time, which is refunded in time gained minutes after the inanimate machinery goes to work. Nothing is spent. Potential wealth has become real wealth. As it is cliched, in the end, problem solution always costs the least if paid for adequately at the outset of the vital problems recognition. Being vital, the problems are evolutionary, inexorable, and ultimately unavoidable by humanity. The constantly put off or undermet costs and society's official bumbling of them clearly prove that man does not know at present what wealth is, nor how much of whatever it may be is progressively available to him." In the end, I think Bucky is really abstracting wealth from its functional aspect, and really what it means in accumulation, and goes back actually about to what Elizabeth pointed out, which is really how are we going to live in this world sustainably. So I think in the end also, Elizabeth, the connection of design actually goes directly into our notions of wealth, because of our current metric for wealth is different than our productivity, our minutes earned back. I think one of the big things to think about right now is how much technology is really changing our lives in terms of being productive beings, and really how much more do we have because of that. So I think I would like to ask the panelists, or Elizabeth, I don't know if anybody from our audience has expressed any interest in responding to the second question. But the question is really about the true meaning of wealth, and in this universal sense, in going forward sustainably. So the question is, do you think that this vision is accurate, and do you agree with Bucky's anticipatory perspective and the ideas on humanity's conception of wealth, our assumption of its continued availability?
Well, I think that one of the things that really attracted me to Bucky too was that the whole misunderstanding of wealth. What he pointed out was that we have, you know, 4 billion billionaires on the planet. Actually, that was the population at the time, but it's even more now, though there are plenty of people living in abject poverty, and hunger is still a problem, even though we have the technology to feed all of those people. Not only the technology, we have the food. It's a breakdown in the distribution of that food that is the problem, and definitely in need of a design solution. And to think that politics is going to provide it is questionable. I think that Bucky always thought that politicians were not the answer, and that a design solution would solve the problem sooner.
Greg, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's sort of interesting, you go back to the 70s and sort of the you know, post Earth Day. And if you look at the, I don't know how many of our audience out there, remember something called the Whole Earth Catalog. And sure. It was sort of this idea, and by the way, that first Whole Earth Catalog, as Stuart Brand, who was the editor and publisher, pointed out, was inspired by the thinking of Buckminster Fuller, whole systems. But the idea was access to tools and access to know-how. And when you think about our ability to understand how we can meet our basic needs, food, energy, shelter, and can do that either as individuals or as families or as communities, that's the beginning of really understanding what wealth is about. And that is, can we provide? Can we do it in a way that sustains us and also doesn't undermine the very source of that wealth, or at least the source of the resources that make that wealth possible, or our life support possible? And so this, you know, it was almost thought of being subversive. When we talked about, you know, organic agriculture and homesteading, I can often remember one of the titles of one of the books was called Radical Agriculture. It's a radical idea that it wasn't only specialists who could understand and how to grow food, healthy food, and provide sustenance. It wasn't only experts or specialists that could build shelters and et cetera. That became sort of the new way of thinking about what wealth really is, as opposed to this artificial system based on currencies that in most cases now don't have any connection with anything with respect to life support. You know, there was a time, you know, kind of connected to, even when it was connected to gold, that was, you know, the gold was given this artificial sort of inflated value because it was scarce, but really didn't have much to do with actual life support and understanding how we do that. So I think, you know, that whole notion of, you know, as Bucky said, if you were on a shipwreck and would you rather have someone give you, like, you know, a couple hundred bucks or a piano top that floated, you probably would opt for the piano top that floated because the $100 wouldn't probably do you much good there. So yeah, I think we've got to reorient ourselves and understand what it is that is not only most important, but also what's most important in passing on to future generations, because again, that is that sort of generational sort of connection is something that, and what is it that we're passing on? What are we passing on? And that's sort of interesting. You look at sort of the First Nation here, and folks, you know, our Native Americans, it was passing on wisdom. It certainly was not passing on accumulated material possessions. That was the most important tradition, and that embedded in those traditions was real know-how and wealth.
Greg, this is Elizabeth. I wanted to invite William Freimuth to join the conversation. He has a number of different comments to share about the relationship of what's necessary for survival in terms of our wealth accounting. So, William, welcome, and go ahead, and please join the conversation.
Hello. Can you all hear me?
Yes,
loud and clear.
Oh, good. I haven't used this.
Yes, we can. Thanks.
The microphone. Wasn't sure if it would
tell us where you're calling.
I'm sorry.
I was just going to invite you to tell us where you're calling, where you're joining us from, William, and then go ahead and share your comment.
I'm from Farmington, New Mexico. That's otherwise currently known as the methane hotspot of the Four Corners. The Four Corners being Colorado, Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico.
Okay.
Farmington is right there in the Four Corners. We're a gas producing, it's called the San Juan Basin, and all the jobs here are in the fossil fuel industries. And the area I've been, I'm an architect here, and we basically are in the utmost denial that climate change even exists as a locality, because all the jobs depend upon fossil fuel, the whole economy here. They're closing the coal mines and that sort of thing. In any case, I've been a practicing architect here, and the comments I'd like to make, first I'd like to ask, how many people are actually online?
There are at least 50 or 60 between being logged into the webinar platform and or joining us by telephone.
Well, I'll try to be brief. Probably, you can interrupt me at any time if I get too windy here, but I just love Bucky and always have. And so I was attracted to your site, and one of my favorite books is Spaceship Earth Operating. And so I'm really intrigued by this, and I've been working on something because you guys keep talking about sustainability, and I think it's of utmost importance, of course, I've been working for a couple years in my semi-retirement to have an effect on this, and I believe that it's a problem, and that everybody's examining the problem in too great a way to see that. And I like your thing of this reconnection that you started with, that in order to solve this problem, people have to recognize we have a problem. And the planet, the population of this planet has not accepted this. There's a lot of things that say the debate is over, blah, blah. The United States just elected a client-denying Congress with a snowball-throwing head of the Environmental Department. We're in denial. It's not broken. It has us all running around like chickens with our heads cut off. There's no unification whatsoever to fight this problem. And the first thing that has to happen before all the other things will take place, once we all unify or reconnect and recognize what we've done. That's the thing that has to be, that's what has to be overcome, is the inertia of denial. It's keeping us from acting. All the technology exists. The technology is way ahead of us. It's all there. I don't have a
question. I think that gets right. Right. Well, I mean, you had summarized that you're really essentially saying that we have what it takes to survive. We have the tools, we have the know-how, and this is a fundamental premise of Bucky's perspective. Greg, Kurt, Pablo, do you want to?
Maybe you would like to comment perhaps on this notion of like the whole emotive.
I'd like to just say one quick thing. Kurt would, but see, I think that. And thank you for the comment. I think because, again, we've got to figure out, you know, what is it that's going to sort of get us to sort of action. But see, my guess is that most people in the world do know that something's wrong, that we have a problem, because they're you know, the 99%, I won't even talk about just the U.S., but many people realize that there is inequality, inequity, there are some serious problems, and I agree with you. Those in, especially in the United States, the powers that be that are elected for the most part by the oligarchy, by the corp. I mean, they get in because they're supported, and you know, they get their support from corporations which want to maintain the status quo. And the last thing, the status quo, which is sort of obviously bolstered by the fossil fuel and, you know, and the corporate system wants to do is to acknowledge that the system doesn't work. So I guess it gets back to the point I was making, is that I think there's a lot more acknowledgement and understanding of the problem within the masses. Now, there's a clear part of the strategy too is to keep us numb and dumbed down to and I use that term, but you know, by overloading us with television programs and movies that try to distract us, and in many cases successfully do. But I think if we were savvy, and I hear what you're saying, we have the know-how, we need to do two things. We need to we've got to become more active. It isn't going to happen just by everyone sitting around saying there's a problem. I think it will take some form of leadership and some form of activism to do it, and that can happen if we connect. And I do think that's what one of the technologies, you know, some of the information technology, if it went beyond just tweeting the latest news clip, but was done in real time as it did in some countries when there were some issues, and actually informed and was used as an organizing tool and an educational tool to help people realize most of us are in the same boat, and it's the boat that's sinking. I think we are close to or have the ability to do that. So I think there's a lot more acknowledgement about the seriousness of the problems that we're facing.
Well, and yeah. I have to point out that we're actually using that technology to do that, and much more than when I was a kid. As a matter of fact, going out and teaching all ages, actually, synergetics, not just synergetic geometry, but actually the geometry of thinking is what Bucky was all about. And actually, I'm very inspired by the fact that the kids right now, they're brought up with ideas. Actually, you know, I was born in 64, so I was a real flower child and was exposed to a lot. We had a Volkswagen van and was all across the country. My father was one of five white students being certified in black studies at Xavier in 1969, and we had a Volkswagen van with Minnesota plates on it in New Orleans for the summer. And that was when this book was written. But we also had a geodesic dome in the backyard. So I think that these ideas have actually infused into the culture, and it's happening right now. That accelerating acceleration is faster now than it's ever been. And we're in the golden age of humanity by what we are able to do and understand down on a molecular level. And Bucky, you know, the charting of the Industrial Revolution with the discovery of the elements, I think, is so brilliant. But he also shows circumnavigation of the planet. But the connectivity of this internet to the information, which Bucky was predicting in Education Automation in 62, which was his third book, and actually it was from a speech that he gave about how education was going to be revolutionized by a two-way television set, is basically, it was a speech that he gave, and then in the 60s he started to write books. His book before Education Automation in 62 was Nine Change to the Moon in 1938. So it was in the 60s that he started to do the download, and he became very popular with the quote-unquote counterculture, which was actually more of a planetary consciousness, and that has permeated the planet. And I think Bucky was one of the prime movers in that. That idea, and it's still inspiring today. That's why I spend as much time as I do with the ideas that. And I never met Bucky. But he's a great teacher that way.
Thank you, Kurt. And Greg, for your very insightful comments. I'm going to try to open this up. We've got a number of people who would like to participate. Gary, I'm going to get to your question about Bitcoin in a minute, but I'm going to open the floor to Dave Buck, who's joined us, to perhaps respond to the thread, and then we can circle back to more ideas about new technologies which are reinventing our concept of wealth. So, Dave. Please join the conversation.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, we can hear you loud and clear. Tell us where you're calling from and then launch right into your comment, Dave. Thanks.
Okay, I'm calling from San Ramon, California, which is in about as the crow flies, 25 miles due east from San Francisco. I'm not prepared for this. Elizabeth, was there a specific question that, I mean, I've been studying Bucky since 1983 after I was fortunate enough to hear his second to the last lecture he ever delivered 2 months before he died. So there's a whole lot of stuff that that I'd like to unpack at some point, but Elizabeth, is there some question?
Just, Dave, that you use the raise hand button, so
I didn't mean to.
That's okay, but I know that you have a lot to share with us. Among many things that that Dave has done in relationship to Bucky's ideas was to republish, help me out here, Dave.
The
Grunch of Giants.
And the audio portion of Bucky's first Integrity lecture back in January of 1983 called Only Integrity is Going to Count.
So maybe if you, you know, you've been listening to this theme here that we've been unpacking, I'm just inviting you to make a quick comment on it and or just welcome you, Dave. It's an honor to have you here with us, and we can move on to someone else's specific question.
Well, thank you, Elizabeth. I appreciate that. I'm very humbled by that. What has come up for me, and there, the information and the clarity with this information is almost on a geometric curve or exponential curve, which started in 1983, and it's reaching. It's very. Awesome! What is happening in the last 6 months or a year? But Bucky points out very very clearly with the that his orientation to the generalized principles that Jamie emphasized last week that was his or last 2 weeks ago his focus was the generalized principles, and that the universe works. It's perfectly as designed. And the universe does not operate at a very high level of integrity. It operates at the highest level of integrity. And of course, we as humans are just part of that. And all of the designs of species, the design of each specific species, Buckley's very clear that we every species is designed with integral equipment that allows it to thrive in its niche. And all of those things are, I'm sorry, my phone just rang. All of those things are very unique and specific. You know, termites operate very differently than mooses. But each one is designed to thrive in its niche as long as it has the integrity of what that design is. Humans, we've gotten off the path. But we have integral equipment that allows us to thrive in our niche, and that's our mind and our brain and our opposable thumbs. So we can, you know, like Bucky said, we are the only species that we are aware of that can understand those generalized principles and use them, but we also makes a statement that we all animals except man adapt to their environment, and that man changes his environment, making it adapt to him. And that's from I seem to be a verb, and that's a really important thing for us to consider is that. You know, like Daniel Quinn said that humans back in the agricultural revolution made a number of shifts, and I feel that Daniel Quinn really supports and augments and amplifies so much of what Bucky brought to us. But in the combination of the two is really, really important information if we are to get into this design revolution and achieve that. Everybody's thriving as he so eloquently pointed out, which was not a wish, a hope, or a dream, but an engineeringly demonstrable fact, and that we could do it in 10 years.
Right. Right.
So, and so that's okay. I'm sorry, Elizabeth. But focusing on those things, that there is an integral design of human beings that is designed to thrive, and we've gotten off the mark because we don't understand some of these relationships that we have to the, and we're trying to dominate, we're trying to change nature, we're not trying to acknowledge, you know, in Bucky said, pay attention to all the clues that nature provides. So that's, I think it's very sage suggestion.
And go ahead, Kurt.
And the thing that I just like to point out, and it fits right in there, is that he said this specialization is a big problem, the over-specialization and the educational system that forces people into that, though we're designed to be comprehensivists from the start. And the quote, it's on page 25 of the electronic book, it's one of my favorites, and it fits right in with what you said. One of humanity's prime drives is to understand and be understood. All other living creatures are designed for highly specialized tasks. Man seems unique as the comprehensive comprehender and coordinating of local universe affairs. If the total scheme of nature required man to be a specialist, she would have made him so by having him born with one eye and a microscope attached to it. So that whole over-specialization making us look at too small of a picture is probably the biggest danger, and that's why his desire to be teaching comprehensivists to do this design revolution. And the thing that I would just say is, it seems to me that there is a design revolution happening for sure. We're in the middle of one, but it's the direction of that design that is key. And you know, hats off to the Buckminster Fuller Institute for having the challenge to highlight so many things that are happening on the planet to actually utilize the technology and principles to solve some of these problems.
You read my mind, Kurt. I was going to mention that all the continuous flow of fantastic ideas from applicants to the challenge through the years really demonstrate that actually, there is a growing wealth of solutions that are available to us. So, go ahead.
Sorry, Pablo. We have a number of other voices that I'd like to try to weave in here if we can. I'm going to toss this over to Susan Werb, and while we're making it possible for her to join us verbally, I'll read her comment. Her question: did Bucky think politics would become obsolete, as in non-existent or powerless? Because while it is obvious that politics will not provide solutions, political entities have actually gained more power and control over resources, wealth, etc. So while the technology exists, biomimicry, design, engineering, 3D printing, metamaterials, sustainable agriculture, and permaculture, clean and renewable energy, etc., any large-scale attempts at innovation and the startup costs, funding, permitting, and law-controlling energy, off-grid living, and education are not only being suppressed, but even criminalized. There's much more, I'll ask Susan to kind of complete her thought there and then invite you all to respond.
Hi.
Hi, Susan. Just share with us where you're calling from, and then
I'm calling from Stuart, Florida, and my background is as a teacher. I worked in the Montessori system and was curious. Actually, one of the questions I had is if Buckminster Fuller was aware of Maria Montessori's pedagogy, because I think he would have loved it, and it goes right along with his philosophy. It's interesting because her cosmology, children at a very young age are actually started in the comprehensive way, in a very global and actually cosmological perspective, before they go down to the specialized detail, which obviously goes along with what you know, his ideas are. And then I worked, taught in high school, and I taught upper level math, and I introduced my kids to Buckminster Fuller's ideas. And, you know, this generation gives me so much hope because they are definitely aware. One of my students graduated and is in a graduate program in New York, totally studying biomimicry engineering and design because of being inspired about all of that. So it's like, on one hand, I have so much hope, but on the other hand, I just kind of wonder, like, what Bucky would think. Like, when he said the idea with politics, and he said, okay, it'll be obsolete. I don't know if he was saying, because it's so inefficient, and it's not working, that it would like not be around, or that we could somehow go around or bypass it. And I mean, just for instance, in the state of Florida, I've tutored a really brilliant boy, and we've had the FBI show up because of his hacking abilities, and he's not doing anything, you know, against society. He's trying to look into free energy, and I also know people that have they're not allowed to live off the grid in Florida. And, you know, people being arrested or having fines because of growing food in their front yard. And I look at all of these as Bucky's vision, you know, a localized, independent, efficient, you know, working with biomimicry design principles. And it just seems... it seems harder and harder, like we're fighting this huge military-industrial complex that is definitely not Buckminster Fuller-inspired, you know, paradigm.
Well, I'm
go ahead. Great.
Sorry, I'm inspired by your comments, and sadly so. If that's the state in Florida, I'm calling from New York, upstate New York. And things are actually, the going back to local agriculture is being encouraged, and a lot of people are going back to that. But by the way, just Bucky did know about Montessori very well, and he was inspired by the comprehensive approach. He actually wrote introductions to a book, Montessori and the Special Child. He wrote an introduction for that, where he talks about it very specifically, if you want to check it out. But again, it's that comprehensive instilling in children that, if it carries through, can really change things. And both of the guys from Google were Montessori taught.
Thank you, Kurt. We are now going to...
Yeah.
And thank you, Susan, for your wonderful, wonderful comments. Greg, did you have something you wanted to add?
Well, I thought, you know, Susan, in asking about, you know, Bucky's relationship with Montessori, it's really important for folks to know that Bucky interacted, and he wasn't insular. He interacted with tons of people and ideas. And I mean, whether, you know, again, ideas of Montessori or, you know, John Cage, he wrote an introduction to a book called Expanded Cinema. He was just really, really trying to figure out how to get these ideas out and was looking for all sorts of avenues. So it wasn't just sort of like, this has to be my ideas. He was really interested in what other people had to say. And I guess the only other point I wanted to point out was that he did feel that politics absolutely does not solve problems. And as Kurt sort of said, he saw politics as sort of just operating more like blood clots that prevented the free flow of information. So that's not to say that governance but certainly not politics.
Yeah, well, and it oh. Sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry, I'm just gonna thanks, Kurt. I'm just going to try to weave some other voices in here. We have Kurt McNamara, who has also joined us this evening. Kurt has been an educator in comprehensive anticipatory design science for many years. We're delighted to have you join us, Kurt. I'm hoping that your audio will be receivable by all of us. Let's give it a shot. Okay.
I don't hear it.
Okay. All right. We're going to. Sharif is going to be communicating with him via email. I'm going to move us back to the question of wealth. We still have a lot of comments about that.
Can I just throw in one thing about politics?
Sure.
It's a quick Bucky story, but he would often say, if you took all of the politicians on the planet and put them on a spaceship and sent them out into space, nothing much would change. But if you took all the technology and did the same thing or put it in the bottom of the ocean, you'd have mass starvation in a matter of weeks. So it's right. All about the design.
Sure. I think, you know, for our third topic of discussion, this notion of wealth as our organized capability to cope effectively with the environment in sustaining our healthy regeneration, decreasing both the physical and metaphysical restrictions of the forward days of our lives. I think we're talking about this notion of wealth of degrees of freedom for more people. So I don't know if Greg, would you like to comment perhaps on the notion of degrees of freedom and how we can reconceive of wealth as a function of our forward sustainable capabilities?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'll be very quick because I know there are a lot of people on the phone and or at least waiting to talk. And I think Elizabeth alluded to one person wanting to talk about Bitcoin. It's sort of interesting that people are now really looking at, you know, even whether it's agriculture or energy, local and community-based systems that are sort of subsystems of the larger systems. And one of the experiments just in Great Barrington at my organization, the Schumacher Center for New Economics, has been an ongoing experiment with local currency. It's not the only one. There are many of them in the United States and other countries. But the idea is to tie currencies back to local resources and have that currency, as Jane Jacobs said, be a form of communication about how the local economy is working and how you support each other by creating sort of not just supply chains but supply loops. So I do think that people, as Kurt said, whether it's through sustainable agriculture, and they're tying all these pieces together, sustainable agriculture, local economic development, now even local currencies, and some of it not so local as with Bitcoin, but trying to give wealth and currency and this whole thing sort of a new meaning that is based on based in community.
I'm certainly glad to hear that because I bring a different perspective, but it has to do more with my own experience with currency from the capital markets and financial perspective, where I think that we're arrived at the point where at least currency as we use it has become completely international. I don't know of many currencies that are local anymore. And so I do think that in the sense of currencies having a connection to real resources, I think that's where the big disconnect is. And I think we can think of notions that Bucky brought up, like having a global resource accounting. Right, that would be a more meaningful way to restore the value to currencies from a global allocation perspective. So I do think we do need to reassess how we think about things. And Bitcoin is a good system to try to remove the current way that it flows, but it still functions on the same notion of value to currency and not that connection that you mentioned, Greg, but to local resources. So how do we bridge that gap? I don't know if anybody would like to respond.
Well, I'll just say that Bitcoin is a design solution that was generated by a bunch of people that just decided to do it as a new model to replace the old, and it's, you know, it's in operation. Whether it will be crushed by the old or not is the question.
Hmm. Well, and I guess just one point I'll make is it's sort of interesting that one of the supporters of the local currency effort in Great Barrington is the Danish government because of their concern over the instability of the euro, and they are on an active sort of survey looking at what are some of the more successful forays into looking at local currency because of the instability. And again, we're seeing it happen. Well, I mean, look at Latin America. Look at what's happening in the EU today. There is a monetary crisis. There's no question. So I don't have an answer, just an observation. And again, part of that just comes back to are there things that community, individuals, families, and communities can gain some measure of control over when they are so vital to meeting their basic needs. So there may be a dichotomy there, but once again, remember that, you know, it's inside, outside, concave, convex, tension, compression. The dualities really do play a part in sort of the synergistic systems.
Hmm. Thanks, great. So, Elizabeth, did we have any comments on online?
A question from Eric Pinuelas, which I'm going to invite him. He would like me to read it. I'm going to need some clarification of what some of this means. So I'll share this with you and then open it up for comment. In that we are following through with what the GPs of old set up for us, following through with that initial metaphysical initiative. Now with the GPs extinct, it is up to us as a collective to reconnect and become aware that we are our own comprehensive thinker, a collective thinker that transcends any one individual and holds the current metaphysical initiative. Okay, so I think that Eric is really, you know, I think bringing up this, you know, enduring concept of Bucky's about the relationship between the physical and the metaphysical. So I'll throw that back to you all, panelists, to maybe just address how he reconciled between these two fundamental aspects of universe and certainly of our human experience.
I guess I would say, I think it's the opening of Synergetics, right? He says the wellspring of reality is metaphysical. And once again, gets back to the generalized principles versus special case. And the generalized principles, I mean, as Kurt, you know, teaches and exemplified in Synergetics, I mean, he talked about, you know, certain types of concepts that are eternal and sizeless, angle and frequency being sort of independent of size and being metaphysical, but can be, when you apply them to special cases, when you apply them to special cases, then they're manifest in terms of physical artifacts. And those physical artifacts are, once again, in many cases, designed to help do what Dave Buck pointed out, is that help humans who are niche, and maybe this is Bucky, I think you used the term niche expanders as opposed to niche adapters. And that is the fact that we can expand or modify our niches is the thing that at least potentially helps us avoid the cul-de-sac that 99% of all other living species have run into, and that is extinction because of, again, they're being so locked into their particular environment. So the two are really sort of the dual side of the same coin. There are, again, principles of leverage and then applications of that in the form of a crane that allows you to manipulate or to design your particular environment to help you adapt and live in that or at least thrive in that particular environment.
And just to add to that, Greg, the main idea that I try to teach in the synergetic workshops, that's why I point out, is synergy, the whole concept of synergetics where the whole can't be predicted by the parts taken separately, which was so central to Bucky's message all the time, as opposed to the Darwinian, Malthusian, there's not enough, it's got to be you or me, and it's actually not synergetic at all. It's the actual opposite of synergy. And that is really the concept and key to get people to understand that actually we can do more with less, and we've been doing it progressively, and we're really good at it, actually. Right at this time, look at the technology in your hand that we're using to do this. So it's actually directing it away from weaponry. Absolutely. towards livingry, and that's the key message. And everybody, it resonates with everybody. I haven't found anybody who, that's why Bucky was traveling around the world spreading that idea.
Absolutely.
And it's that.
Pablo. Yeah?
Sorry, Kurt, I cut.
Well, it was just, I was going to say, it goes back to chemistry, too. The word synergy came out of chemistry, and on a chemical level, it's been happening all the time. Nothing about hydrogen and oxygen taken separately predict water. So that nature of the universe itself is the real key to it, and Bucky was on to that. That's where the science gets thrown in there with design science. It's our ability to actually understand those principles that set us apart. And probably my favorite Bucky quote ever, I have it on my Facebook page, is, monkeys don't tie knots. If they did, the jungle would be full of them.
That is great.
But there is a sort of synergy and that occurs in nature, as Bucky points out, in buying endowing species with certain 180 degree drives, right, to quench thirst or to appease their hunger. But in doing so, in a world that's interconnected and always moving, they inadvertently accomplish other functions in the universe or nature or the ecosystem. You said you can't just do one thing. So the drive burden into the cross-pollination, right, of plants, it's not a conscious effort on the part of the bee, but it's part of the design of the system. And what we as humans can do is consciously create that synergy, consciously create the whole that in most cases can be greater than the sum of its part, not just unknown.
Greg, allow me to just jump in. I like where you're bringing up the notion of recession and a great example of the honeybee that, unbeknownst to itself, is pollinating at that 90-degree angle our face. I think it's that Bucky was encouraging people to do the thing that they think that needs to be done. And in doing so, there may be this processional effect that, unbeknownst to that person, they have kicked off something. And there is an interesting comment that Maggie made that said, you may never know what the purpose of your life is, right? Because there is some reaction in the universe, processionary to you, that happens when you do what you think that needs to be done.
And if you do it comprehensively and correctly, remember what he said, then it will be inherently beautiful. It will be inherently elegant. And if you do have other inadvertent things happen, in most cases, they're beneficial, not the unintended consequences that are harmful. When you design it right, the unintended consequences are nice surprises.
Right.
Right.
I'm just going to jump in with a comment from Jerry Spicer, who is joining us from Melbourne, Australia. So it really gives us all a sense of how truly global distributed this discussion is. Welcome, Jerry. He was responding to Susan's comments, and he says it used to be illegal to have water tanks in your backyard in the city. Now it is legal and encouraged. The world is in transition, and it is up to individual organizations to be the trim tabs for humanity in the same way as Bucky was. One day, it will be encouraged in Florida to connect to the grid and grow veggies. Thanks, Gary, for joining us. So,
Bravo.
Yeah.
Exactly. So probably, you
know, as our technology changes, so do the constraints.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Maybe we have time for one more question to be posed before we close out here.
Well, the fourth question for our discussion tonight was on the concept of ownership. Like he states, possession is becoming progressively burdensome and wasteful, and therefore obsolete. So, as we have moved into new business models that have emerged as of late, especially powered by network computer systems, our phones, the slab in your pocket, we've also enabled new ways of doing the things that we knew how to do 5 or 10 years ago without ownership of vehicles or different specialized tools. So I think it's a very interesting and very topical at this moment in which we are in transition, and more we're relying less on owning hardware, and I think it's a part of what the golden age of humanity that Kurt mentioned.
And the fact that in most major cities in the world now, they're getting bike shares around shows an example of just that. Like, it's much more convenient to be able to just grab a bike and go somewhere else with it and not have to own it and share them. And that's happening. The technology is implemented already.
Yeah, and
I could say the same
Ken
with
Burns, who was
the cars, right? People don't.
Oh yeah, exactly. Go ahead, Rick.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to bring the car share exactly. So.
Well, and just the sharing economy. Actually, on the social media this week, there's been an article that's been going around the end of capitalism, but the whole idea of the sharing economy and actually finance, you know, the crowdsourcing of finance as well as Wikipedia. I mean, that sort of thing that's happening extremely quickly, if you think about it. It's changing the planet more than we'll ever fully comprehend, I think. But to understand that and then help direct it, I think the comment from Melbourne was beautiful in that way. And yes, hopefully, Susan, it will reach Florida swiftly, because that's the problem that needs to be solved.
Thanks, Kurt.
There's a great program. I think it's called I think it's called Tech Shops. But and I know it. I think it originated in Pittsburgh. But people who have ideas, entrepreneurial ideas, product ideas. There are a number of these places set up, and what they contain contain machinery. The lathes and saws, bandsaws, all types of equipment. You come in with your idea, they help you make it happen. Even if you've never used the tool before, they show you, they basically determine, here's what you're going to need to actually create your product. It will give you training on that particular machine and see if your product comes to fruition rather than sort of necessarily shipping it out. Two things happen. People become sort of well-versed in starting using different types of tools, but they don't have to own them. They come in and they use them. And I think that we're finding, you know, maker groups are doing the same thing. And you know, again, getting back
the
to some of
the movement
about Kurt, you know, 3D printing now, right, is making manufacturing not necessarily something that has to be this huge factory that's owned by, you know, oligarch, but can be now sort of a shared resource as well.
So 3D printing is now also enabling technologies that none of our production methods before enabled. So it's also literally transforming our technology.
And I prefer the original name. Rapid prototyping was really the whole 3D printing came out of that. But it's the ability to make these prototypes and refine it at home with the technology that we have in our house. And it's phenomenal because the kids are learning it. I mean, the generation that's grown up with this is implementing it in amazing ways. And hopefully the shift to living room will happen.
And they're coming up with products and helpful things, not to make a profit, but because they want to help. some, right? You know, whether it's prosthetics. Remember, you know, that old...
Exactly.
So many of them. Because I'm trying to make a bundle, I want to do something for the best, for the betterment of humanity.
Yeah, there's so many out there, too. Not to say that there aren't problems, but that's the whole idea. You look at the problem around you and solve it, and the tools to do that are more available than ever.
It's always double-edged sword, at least double-edged, right?
Right, but I think, you know, the part that is so inspiring about Bucky, he actually was taking those generalized principles and applying them, so with the Demaxian house, the Demaxian car, all of the things that he did that led up to the discovery of the dome and the ability to span space, yep. The clear span structures, which is phenomenal, and, you know, now on that molecular level, what we're doing is equally as phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, his notion of ephemeralization is that other one of the other overriding right concepts that, yeah. as you said earlier, Kurt, and it's come to. I mean, that's absolutely happening, and you just blink and you can see where things are getting smaller and smaller and more accessible. So he saw that coming.
And as he points out in this book, that computers are going to make, they're going to be the specialists, and that allows us to go back and be comprehensivists.
That's right.
There's no need for us to be that specialist. The computers can handle that. And if you think about the history of the word, just in World War II, computers meant a person who was sitting and calculating ballistic charts. That's my parents' lifetime ago. And now, look at what computers can do. It makes that, and to calculate one number on that chart, it would take one person over a day.
And we're self-publishing. We're doing things, communicating with one another in ways that, and really, you know, on relatively inexpensive software. Certainly, the machines are getting much less expensive, but you're able. You know, the unleashing of creativity and coming up with new ways to communicate, right? I mean, PDF publications, sometimes they can be a little overwhelming, but they really do allow individuals and organizations to do things that were beyond their physical or financial means before. And that's liberating, and that is part of the getting back to our, you know, discussion about the design science revolution, the fact that there are, you know, people are realizing that we are sharing some common problems, some real serious problems, but there are some real solutions out there, and they're being demonstrated. Part of the problem is, you know, we don't get some of these solutions published in our daily newspapers. They certainly don't show up on every once in a while, the feel-good stories show up on the nightly news, but for the most part, a lot of the stuff is going without the network, as you pointed out, Kurt, the social network that people now really are using in a way to communicate some things that work. Well, we'd be isolated.
But most of it's happening online, and eventually the old stream media wakes up to it and does a story or two. But it's already happening, and it's happening globally, and it's happening fast. And the thing I point out, like the open source and creative commons and all of those things, go back to this idea of possession. It's actually a sharing economy where they're giving it away and giving away music. It's destroyed the music industry, but people have a studio that just for video studio in 1996, you know, it was $50,000 worth of gear in 1990, and it's gone progressively cheaper. So now the editing facility that people carry around with them, they're more than happy to give away.
Yeah, you know what the analogy is? It's sort of, we're saying, look, the revolution is under, the design science revolution is underway. And it's actually, as you say, it's pretty ubiquitous. And it's, you know, again, we're not saying, but it's sort of like putting together one of Bucky's tensegrity figures, right? You can start, you know, it's a floppy mess on your table, and you start connecting some of the connecting wires and some of the, you know, connecting them to your solid struts, and you can be pretty near the end of completing it, and it still looks like a floppy mess, right? And then, and so what happens is that's the way some of these systems come together. You're progressing, but if you were to look at it from the outside, you'd say, no, it's still a mess, and we must be years away from this, from us having to achieve what it is we're trying to achieve. But lo and behold, if you put that maybe third to the last strut in, all of a sudden the tensegrity structure starts to take shape, and then boom, it becomes, you know, it snaps into shape. You could have given up. You could have given up a few steps before because it looked like it was futile. And that's, again, getting back to the center, the whole system. So you've got to understand where you're trying to go and what that system looks like. And I think we're there, and things are still a floppy mess out there, but that doesn't mean that we aren't close to really coming up with some really sound.
The kids that are coming up now, actually last Sunday on Bucky's 120th birthday, I did a group of high schoolers from all over the country at RPI that are on a two-week camp, and I did a four-hour workshop with them, and, you know, teaching them what a tetrahedron is and just using the basics of synergetics and then they were building models of buckyballs, and they are the ones that will inherit whatever we do. But I think, you know, we're on course, and it's about connecting it, as you say, Greg. And I think, you know, that's one of the great things about the Buckminster Fuller Institute too. It's an organization that is aimed at those connections and promoting those that are doing it.
Sorry, guys. Kurt, Greg, thank you so much for your comments. I think it's the best thing to think about is the changes coming to education and to how the next generation will have access to what Bucky thought of as wealth, which is really knowledge and access to knowledge.
Yes.
So on a high note, this is all the time that we have for this session, but I wanted to thank you, thank our participants, everybody that joined in on the conversation. We encourage you to share your thoughts, give us your feedback, and as always, we thank you deeply for being part of this experiment and your listening experience. I think that I want to also thank Kurt and Greg for such an animated conversation. And with this,
thank you, Pablo, for framing the discussion so beautifully. Thank you. And thank you all for joining us. We will be in touch with you in the next 24 hours. We hope you'll take a couple of minutes to just respond to a quick survey so we can improve our experience, your experience, as we move forward with the discussion group. We will be meeting again in 2 weeks for the third session on Operating Manual. Please check out the offering of the book in Apple iTunes and Kindle. And with that, enjoy the rest of your evening in all parts of the world. For some of you, dawn is probably arriving soon. Thank you so much for joining us, and we hope you'll be back.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.